Good Monday morning, everybody. Welcome into the Rundown here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. I am Chase McCabe. He is Ryan Porth. Marquise Munson back at the Wholesale Link Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. And our goal for this Monday, Ryan, be like Mike. That's all we want to do is be like Mike. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. But isn't that our goal every day, not just this Monday?
Yeah, it's been my goal since I knew who or what a Michael Jordan was, which was probably... I was about 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's been my goal, to be like Mike. Really enjoyed The Last Dance last night. I feel like we say this every week of, okay, probably the best two episodes to date, but if I had to rank them all, those two last night would probably be my favorites.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it because gambling was involved?
Well, I'm fascinated by that because it's always been, there's been so many rumors surrounding Michael and his gambling and of whether, and I'm sure they're going to get into this even more next week, but whether that when he left for, you know, to go play baseball, was that a secret suspension because of the gambling and everything? So, yeah, I mean, that had a lot to do with it. But the Kobe relationship, I thought, you know, how they started off that episode was powerful. And, you know, I talked to a few people that were a little bit emotional because Kobe was actually in it, and that was new footage of Kobe. So, that was a big part of it, and the ever developing changing relationship between Michael Jordan and Jerry Krause.
Well, I don't know if that relationship is necessarily changing. It just
we're learning more and more.
Sure. But I don't think those two exchanged a lot of Christmas cards over the years. The more and more we watch it. I thought the episodes were great last night. When you compare them to the first two waves of them, you know, the previous two Sundays, I thought they were maybe just a small tick below because there was so much drama with Scottie Pippen, so much drama with Dennis Rodman. And I thought, you know, last night was obviously a lot about the Dream Team and Michael Jordan as a whole. I thought it was very good. I just didn't think it was as – I didn't think it had the pizzazz that the Scottie Pippen and Dennis Rodman focused ones had. But this is the best sports documentary that has ever been released. We're not even done with it. And I'm questioning after last night how they're fitting this or going to fit this into 10 episodes.
Yeah, I know.
They could have easily done 20.
Well, when you say it's the best sports documentary, I agree with you. That it's the best one that's just about sports, and there's not really a whole lot of negativity connected to it. The OJ one was fascinating. I mean, the OJ Made in America, but that obviously was about something different and not just sports. So I agree with you. I love how they've done it so far, and, you know, I love and hate that I have to wait a week for the next two episodes, but, you know, it kind of gets you going on a Sunday night, gets you ready for the week, and then you have something to look forward to next Sunday, because as we know, we don't have live sports to discuss right now. But I did want to talk about that opening scene that they show the All-Star game and he's at the Garden and Magic coming in the locker room and just going back and forth with Magic and Larry Bird's coaching. But then he gets on the court with that Laker boy, as they referred to him in the East locker room, but 19-year-old Kobe Bryant, who made the All-Star team as a starter. I believe he was coming off the bench, if I'm not mistaken, for the Lakers. He wasn't actually a starter yet for the Lakers. Then he makes the All-Star game, and you just see the back and forth between MJ and Kobe. And Kobe Bryant says in the documentary that he doesn't get five championships without MJ.
At that point, Michael provided a lot of guidance for me. Like, I had a question about shooting this turnaround shot, so I asked him about it. And, you know, he gave me a great detailed answer. But on top of that, he said, if you ever need anything, give me a call. It's like my big brother. You know, I truly hate having discussions about who would win one-on-one. And you're a fan saying, hey, Kobe, you beat Michael one-on-one. I feel like, yo, what you get from me is from him. I don't get five championships here without him. Because he guided me so much and gave me so much great advice.
Kobe Bryant giving a lot of props to Michael Jordan. And I don't know exactly when that interview was taped, but I believe it was very close to his untimely passing. But you just hear the respect there. And for him to say that he wouldn't have those five championships if it wasn't for the advice that he got from Michael Jordan, that's powerful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, you know, that was certainly really touching, the way they started the episode with, get out of here, Maverick. The way they started the episode with, you know, in loving tribute to Kobe Bryant. And then it was basically that portion that we just played. That's how episode five started. That was definitely very cool. And, you know, it kind of morphed into the Dream Team conversation. And, you know, one takeaway that I had last night, and I've thought this before, but I think it just goes to show you that era of the NBA, you can make an argument that that was the best era that the NBA has ever experienced, and it's going to be very difficult to top because you had all these generational stars playing at the same time, and you had these generational stars that weren't, you know, skipping from team to team like you have the generational stars doing in today's game. And because of that, you had the intense rivalries that came with it, like the Pistons that we saw in Pistons Bulls that we saw last week, and the Bulls and Knicks like we saw last night. I really wish that era of the NBA, A, that I was alive for it and, you know, able to actually appreciate it, or B, it could happen right now, but that's just not reality.
Yeah, I remember, like, this season that this whole thing is centered around, the 97-98 season, his last season, I remember it. I watched it. I knew that the Bulls were going for their sixth championship, but I was very young, and obviously I don't remember the first three-peat at all. So I would like to be able to relive those glory days and the rivalries that you have, because rivalries mm-hmm. are just different today. You know, they just don't carry the same weight as they used to. And I don't know if that's really against anyone per se, that maybe the bar was just set so high, but I just feel like there was more put into, like, you see it today. Isaiah Thomas and Michael Jordan, I feel like they may have a respect for one another, but they don't like each other, even mm-hmm. to this day.
Right.
And I just don't know if that type of rivalry really exists anymore.
Well, not only that, because you're bringing up a case of individual to individual, but team to team. Like, yeah. there's so much change in free agency now that it's difficult to sustain, you know, the team versus team rivalries that aren't the legendary ones. Like, for instance, in hockey, Canadiens, Bruins, those two franchises will always hate each other. But the Canadiens and the Bruins players back in the 70s and 80s that were with those teams for the duration of their careers, that rivalry was at a higher level back then than it is now, because the cast of characters, for the most part, change every 2, 3, 4 years, and you don't build up that same level of hatred. And I think you could say the same thing about the NBA. Like, the Clippers and the Lakers play in the same building, and it's fascinating that Kawhi Leonard starred for the Clippers and Paul George, and then you have Anthony Davis and LeBron for the Lakers. Those cast of characters could change in the next 2 or 3 years, maybe 4. And then the Clippers and the Lakers, this rivalry that could have been, you know, one of the most epic things we see for a 5, 6, 7 year stretch, we only see it for a couple years. You know, so
that's the thing that drives me nuts about the NBA.
Yeah. So I go back to what I just said a couple minutes ago of, I wish, you know, these athletes, these players could stay in the organizations longer than they do because of free agency, so that we could see the 90s style, 80s and 90s style rivalries in present day 2020.
Right, and I think there's a lot that has gone into that why players get the contracts they do, why they don't stick around very long and bounce from team to team. But you do have to look at Scottie Pippen's situation, and I think that was a little bit of a lesson for players, and that could have factored into why things are the way they are now. I mean, he signed a 7-year deal on a contract that the value of it became devalued very fast. And so I think that players look at that, and you don't see these long-term deals anymore. I know he's not the only example, but I'm just using him for this conversation.
Well, the max in the NBA is, what, 4 or 5 years?
Yeah.
Like, you can't go beyond that with a contract. So, you know, it's not just the individuals looking at that. It's the NBA and its player association agreeing to a labor contract that doesn't allow someone to get more than a 5-year deal, you know?
Yeah.
But you bring up Scottie Pippen, and we were talking about this after the first couple episodes when Jerry Krause was cast as more of a, you know, maybe more of a villain within that dynasty than someone who was looked at in a good eye by the Bulls players. And we sat here 2 weeks ago today and said, I wonder what we're going to see throughout these episodes with Scottie Pippen and Jerry Krause to see if there's more to that story. And that story that we saw 2 weeks ago was in 98. Well, the Olympic experience in 92 and how Scottie Pippen wanted that new contract. But, you know, Jerry Krause and Jerry Reinsdorf were so enamored with Tony Kukoc being the future of the Chicago Bulls, and how the Bulls players, you know, kind of looked at Tony Kukoc as this player that didn't deserve all the hype, and they played Croatia in the Olympics and just completely, you know, dominated him in that first matchup. And
they embarrassed him.
Right. And looked at him as this bad guy because of what Bulls management was saying about Kukoc versus Scottie Pippen. And that is yet another thing that you can point back to in the previous episodes as to maybe why Scottie Pippen was feeling, you know, a lot of that vitriol towards Jerry Krause in 1997.
Yeah, but I will ask this question when we come back. If the Krause versus Jordan Pippen, if that doesn't happen, are we talking about the Bulls in the same light? We'll do that when we come back, but first, some sad breaking news out of Miami. Legendary Hall of Fame coach Don Shula has passed away at the age of 90, according to multiple reports that are just coming out. Don Shula, of course, known for the perfect season, being the only head coach, the only team to go undefeated in the regular season and then the playoffs to win the Super Bowl. So Don Shula passing away at the age of 90, according to multiple reports. Mm. His family looking like they have confirmed that. So may be the greatest of all time when it comes to coaching. I know Bill Belichick has, of course, had a lot to do with that argument as of late. But Don Shula, dead at the age of 90, will return with more here on The Rundown, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back in, ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're streaming live on the Game Nashville app as well. If you're working from home, you can download that app. Just search the Game Nashville in the Google Play or the App Store. You can also enable Alexa or Google Home and listen to us that way as well. Chase McKay, Ryan Porth, Marquise Munson hanging out with you, discussing The Last Dance. So I have this question for you, Ryan. I'm sitting there watching the documentary, and I've really thought about this in previous episodes, but one of the narratives in this is they create, or they show you this relationship or lack of between Jerry Krause and mainly Michael Jordan, later Scottie Pippen, later Phil Jackson, but really the team as a whole. And, you know, as I said, Jerry Krause is not here to defend himself. He passed away a couple of years ago. So every clip of him in this documentary is an old one. And some of the ones that they have used are, you know, he's talking about the organization, that it's not just the players, that it's not just the team, that it's the whole organization. And the narrative that is created is that you saw some jealousy out of Jerry Krause, that he was the architect behind this dynasty, but in his mind, he didn't get enough credit for it, that all the credit went to Phil Jackson or the players and not enough to Jerry Krause. And thus leads us to this whole thing of him wanting to blow it up and saying that Phil Jackson will not return. And he was adamant about that. And then, of course, we learned that Michael Jordan says, well, if Phil's not back, then I'm not back. And ultimately, we know what happens, that he ends up retiring at the end of this season and the dynasty is over. But I ask this question. if there isn't this vitriol, the word that you use, between Jerry Krause and Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, is the dynasty as we know it, does it exist? Or was that something that, that kind of drove both sides, that they wanted to one-up the other?
I think it still would exist. I don't know if we can answer that question, Chase. I mean, I honestly don't know enough about that entire situation. I want to see this whole thing through before coming to a 100% conclusion on that question. But what I will say is, no matter who the GM would have been, Michael Jordan, it's very evident back when we saw it live, and now especially now that we're seeing this documentary, Michael Jordan had maybe the most competitive streak within any athlete we've ever seen. And I thought it was very evident while they were flipping quarters or flipping coins in a security room last night during the documentary, where he's trying to beat the security guard at whatever, whatever that game was. I couldn't understand quarters. What they were doing.
It's called quarters. You flip.
Never played it.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
But
basically, you're flipping. You're trying to get a heads or a tails, and that's what they were doing.
But he's taking on these security guards in quarters, and he's being very intense about it. And it's on a game day, you know. And
that's the competitive side.
And that is exactly what I'm getting to. Like he had this competitive nature about him that you can't teach, you can't coach, you can't expect really anybody else in the world to have that kind of competitive streak that just naturally forced him to put the team on his back in numerous situations. And yeah, maybe the Jerry Krause situation stoked the fire, and it's evident that it probably did stoke that fire within him. But that fire has been burning the entire documentary, whether Jerry Krause is mentioned or not.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, the gambling conversation, you know, he even said it himself that he doesn't have a gambling problem. He's just competitive, which, okay, well, they might tie together, but to each their own. I think, though, that this was something that the Zen master Phil Jackson used. I believe that he saw it early on that there was tension, and he knew that the tension wasn't going to go away, that as MJ's star got brighter, you know, he was going to get a little bit of an ego, which he did. Pippen was going to get a little bit of an ego. That happens. And Phil had to be the one in the middle to try and make it all work. And I think that he used the negative energy and turned it into a positive and turned it into to use – for Michael, because he knew how competitive Michael was. That's what I think happened.
Sure. I think you're onto something there. I think The Last Dance, the 97-98 season, I think you can attribute that to Jerry Krause and what you're discussing here and what you're proposing with this Jerry Krause question. I think you can say that about the 97-98 season more than any other time within that dynasty.
That's fair.
Because they knew it was the last dance, and he had pissed off basically the entire organization below him with the, you know, with going public that everything was in its last year, from Phil Jackson to, you know, the core of the team. And I think that this 97-98 season that we're seeing play out in this amazing footage, I think that has been a driving force, but not the driving force behind it, but more so in the 97-98 season than any other season.
Just a question that I wanted to bring up. One thing that we didn't get to in the first segment that was, when we alluded to it, that was depicted a lot last night, was the Dream Team. And I thought the respect, you know, Charles Barkley was in it, was featured throughout, because not only did he play with Michael on the Dream Team in 92, but they went up against each other in the finals about a year later when Chuck was with the Phoenix Suns. And I also watched his interview that he did with Scott Van Pelt after the documentary last night, and it was fantastic, as Chuck usually is. But the Dream Team, I mean, just that, how that whole thing came to be, Chuck Daly, how he was able to control all those egos, because you can't tell me for a second that guys that make millions of dollars don't have egos, especially when you have Magic and Bird and MJ and Pippen and Charles Barkley all on the same team. But what did you think about that, and also the clips of Isaiah discussing being left off?
Well, I thought the Isaiah portion made sense, because they wanted that team to be as unified as possible. And the fact that he had some bad blood with multiple members of that Dream Team, maybe many members. And, you know, here's one thing about Michael Jordan that is evident through this too, is that he holds a grudge. And it's very obvious that he wasn't going to let that go for the Dream Team with Isaiah Thomas. And yeah, he was a pretty big snub on that team. But if Isaiah Thomas is on that team and they're not as close, they don't mesh as well as they actually did, if Isaiah was on that team, then is it truly the Dream Team? Maybe, but maybe the fact that Isaiah is around the team in Barcelona, maybe that becomes a thing, and it's not as enjoyable of an experience for that entire cast of characters. So the reasoning behind it did make sense. Not saying it was right, but it absolutely made sense.
He brought it on himself.
Sure.
That's how I look at it.
It was a result to him being a part of the Bad Boys and being a part of the rivalries with Larry Bird's Celtics, you know, Magic Johnson's Lakers, and Michael Jordan's Bulls. And right then and there, you're talking about three pillars of the Dream Team: Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, and Michael Jordan.
Yeah. So I just like how they depicted that whole thing. And then that's where the gambling comes in, playing cards. And Chuck talked about that on SVP too, that,
yeah,
he said it was always Magic and Mike against Charles Barkley and Scottie Pippen. He goes, and me and Scottie didn't have the kind of money that Magic and Mike had, but you know, they still tried to take it all.
I actually thought the practice footage in Barcelona may have been the most fascinating part of last night's episodes 5 and 6, because I don't know about you, I've never seen that footage.
It was completely
fascinating to see all those NBA stars go at it in a competitive scrimmage, and Michael Jordan essentially take over the scrimmage. And then you see these other Hall of Fame legends in the NBA say, you know what, that was the day where we all knew that Michael Jordan was it, that he was the king of the NBA when he took over that scrimmage. And really, that was
in Magic's line of, you know, I trash talked him and I wish that I hadn't done that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that was probably the most competitive game in Barcelona that summer, because the U.S. was so much better than everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know if you, I keep referencing the SVP show after, but he had a clip, and they're going to run the full interview next week, of Brooks Koepka. Now, Brooks Koepka is talking about playing golf with MJ.
Hmm.
And that he had, you know, they were playing, and he had him beat. He was, you know, he was ahead, and he started trash talking him a little bit. And that Michael got real quiet as they got to 16. And Brooks says something, you know, when they get to 17, like, oh, you know, what's going on? And he goes, it's the fourth quarter and I don't lose. And Michael ends up coming back and beating him.
Wow. I did not stick around on SportsCenter that late. I saw the Chuck interview and then went to bed. Here's another thing that really stood out to me last night, Chase, is, you know, they're going through the 97-98 season, but they're also rewinding it back and taking us through the dynasty years that lead up to 97-98. And they're doing this, you know, jumping back and forth. And, you know, I thought last night we saw a lot of examples of why in episode either 7 or 8, we're going to see Michael Jordan announce his retirement. And everything, the pressure and the mental burden of being the global superstar that he was and still is today having that target on his back at all times, how when he was outside of his hotel room, he was always mobbed by fans and media. And the fact that he mentioned that he was, you know, basically more relieved than excited after they beat the Suns in 93, I think we are seeing examples within those two episodes last night of what led him to ultimately retiring in 93. And, yeah. You know, that was another big takeaway for me last night. And I can't wait to see how all of that unfolds next Sunday.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that too, of them talking about talking about the baseball and going and playing with Birmingham. And I actually think he played a game in Nashville, because there was the Sounds had moved to AAA at that point, but there was a short-lived Southern League team that played at Greer Stadium as well, and I believe he played a game there. So we'll see that part next week. One thing that we put out on Twitter yesterday at 102.5 The Game, you've been putting out these questions of the day, and we did a build your own dream team. You had, yes, a salary cap of $15, but we put this out, and the choices were: for point guard, you had Magic Johnson, Oscar Robertson, Steph Curry, Isaiah Thomas, John Stockton; shooting guard, MJ, Kobe, Dwayne Wade, Jerry West, Clyde Drexler; small forward, LeBron, Larry Bird, Julius Erving, Kevin Durant, Elgin Baylor; power forward, Tim Duncan, Karl Malone, Charles Barkley, Kevin Garnett, Dirk Nowitzki; centers, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Wilt Chamberlain, Shaq, Bill Russell, Hakeem Olajuwon. You had a $15 salary cap. Mine, I went with Isaiah and MJ on the same team because I'm a glutton for punishment. Dr. J, Dirk, and Wilt.
Okay, that's not a bad lineup. I mean, no matter how you cut it out of this, it's a dream team. And just to further accentuate what you said, you know, the position, the names of the positions you said, it all escalates downward. So Magic Johnson was $5, Oscar, yeah, 4, Steph 3, Isaiah 2, and John Stockton 1, just to use point guard as an example. I took John Stockton, Michael Jordan, Kevin Durant, Karl Malone, and Shaq.
I like that. That's a good lineup.
I felt you have a little bit of everything in there. You have John Stockton, who can basically just pass the ball and accumulate 30 assists per game, to MJ and Durant and Karl Malone and Shaq. And yeah, you have some great defense in there. You have some outside shooting. You have some post dominance. I went with those five. Thought that was the best way that you could skin that cat.
Yeah, so you can still check that out. It's on our Twitter page at 102.5 The Game if you want to play along. I saw a lot of people quote tweeting it, and you know, you had some arguments in there, which are always fun, because what's so tough is the first three, especially for shooting guard, MJ, Kobe, Dwayne Wade. That's a tough choice to make, but you can only choose one. You can only take one from each position. So yep, that's what makes it kind of fun. And you've done a great job of putting those out there. You've also, one thing that we've come up with, and I know you tweeted my design, our uniform contest. Enter the ESPN Game Nashville's uniform drawing contest for a chance to win a jersey from either the Predators, Nashville SC, Nashville Sounds, Vanderbilt Football, or MTSU Basketball. You can just download the jersey template from thegamenashville.com or draw your own and submit for your chance to win. There will then be different categories the game listeners will vote on, the top three from hockey, soccer, football, basketball, and baseball, with the winner getting a jersey from that particular sport. Enter today at thegamenashville.com. We shift gears to the NFL, lots of news and notes, and the Titans. They picked up the option on one, declined on the other. We'll discuss when we come back. The Rundown, ESPN, 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into The Rundown, ESPN, 102.5 The Game. Chase McCabe, Ryan Porth, Marquise Munson is back at the Wholesale Link Studios, powered by RumbleOn.com. Good Monday to you. Hope that you are having a good one. So the Titans, they decided not to pick up the option on Corey Davis. They did pick up the option on Adoree Jackson. We discussed some of this on Friday, Ryan. And I look at this, and for me, it's a no-brainer that I'm not paying $15.6 million a year for Corey Davis, even though He was a top five pick. He has not lived up to that. And I understand that we hold where a guy was selected in the draft over their head for their entire career if they are, in fact, a first-round pick. You know, if you're really third on, nobody cares because you overachieve if you stick around. But, you know, Derek Mason's whole career, it was brought up he was a fourth-round pick, but obviously he overachieved being a fourth-round pick. But for Corey Davis, he was the fifth overall pick, and he just hadn't lived up to it. But that means for the fifth-year option, he gets paid more. So I don't blame the Titans at all. You can't pay him that kind of money. That's way too much for the production you get out of him. Now, it's about $10 million for Adoree Jackson. I'm fine with that. I still think there's a lot more for him to prove, but I'm cool with the decision that they made. What about you?
I thought it was the only decision that John Robinson had to make. You know, you had to pick up the Adoree Jackson fifth-year option, and by no means could you justify picking up Corey Davis's fifth-year option because of what the salary would have been for that one season due to him being a top 10 pick. You know, whether or not they come to an agreement on any sort of extension, I don't think Corey Davis's camp would want to do that before this season, because Corey Davis could have a good contract year and then end up making a lot more money in free agency next year than he would on an extension right now with the Tennessee Titans. So we'll have to see how this plays out for Corey Davis and what could be his last season with the Tennessee Titans here in 2020. I think the bigger question for Corey Davis is, what does he do with the contract year, and do the Titans bring him back beyond 2020? And, you know, if Corey Davis goes bananas and maybe sniffs a 1,000-yard season in 2020, I think he's going to price himself out of Tennessee. If you have another season like last year, then where he's up and down, you can't really count on him to be a consistent number two receiver, then I don't know if the Titans bring him back. So I think there's a small happy medium in there where he has a successful season, but not too successful for him to hit any sort of jackpot next NFL offseason where he ends up coming back beyond his rookie contract.
Here's the damned if you do, damned if you don't question about Corey Davis. Because how many times do you see a guy in a contract year just ball out, and it's because everybody knows, oh, it's a contract year, so they're trying to get paid. In his situation, number one, I don't think he fits what the Titans are trying to do. I don't know why necessarily. It seems like it's never worked through all the offenses that they've had. I still think he's a good receiver. I just think he could be in the category of needs a fresh start. And that's probably, in my opinion, what's going to end up happening. But let's just say that the scenario you threw out there plays out, that he ends up just having a lights out season, and that he and A.J. Brown just tear it up as a tandem. And it comes to the point where John Robinson has a very, very tough decision to make. As a fan, as a Titans fan, they're going to look at that and go, well, you got to pay him. I mean, look at the year he just had. In my possibly cynic point of view, I'm going to look at it and go, okay, well, it was a great season. Obviously, he was a big part of their success, but where the hell was that the first 4 years?
Mm-hmm. You know, almost like the Albert Haynes syndrome.
Right. Like, where was that? Is he just a guy that's going to show up when he knows he's going to get paid? Or was this truly a turnaround? And the fact of the matter is, you just don't know. You would have to gamble. I mean, you would have to roll the dice and re-sign him and just hope that you're going to get that guy every year. And I just don't know if you are.
No, and I don't know if GM John Robinson is going to do that.
Well,
you only have so many big contracts to throw around. I get it. You want to have a solid receiver on the opposite side of A.J. Brown. Maybe you could find that receiver in the first or second round next year, like you didn't spend a pick on receiver this year. I mean, I guess that is certainly a possibility for them to dip back into the draft next April and find their receiver, their number two receiver, to go with A.J. Brown. To your point, I don't know if you can count on Corey Davis to be a consistent year in, year out top two receiver in this league. You know, you said you think he's a good receiver. I think he's a talented receiver with average results.
That's fair. That's a fair way to put it, but they don't.
I mean, he has two. He was the fifth overall pick, and through three seasons, he has two 100-yard games. And they are the two games that we always say, you know what? Well, Corey Davis in the Philly and the New England games in 2018, he looked like the number five overall pick. Well, those are two games out of the three seasons that he's played in a Titans uniform. So if he goes out there and balls out in 2020 and has, you know, a 900, 1,000-yard season or even better, I'm still going to be skeptical because of the opportunity that he had as the number one receiver in this offense and did very little with it. Then you have A.J. Brown come in, overshadow him in 2019. Corey Davis was a non-factor in a lot of games this year. I don't know if you can sit there and say, you know what, Corey Davis, he had a great season. Let's pay him $12, $13 million a year. You can't do that. If I'm John Robinson, you can't do that. There's a fine line that Corey Davis would have to land at in 2020, in my view, for you to justify bringing him back. Because you've got A.J. Brown, and when A.J. Brown's contract comes up, you want to pay him the big money. You would think at that point here in the next two or three years that A.J. Brown is going to get a pretty big contract. And you don't want to find yourself in a position where you give Corey Davis a big contract and then you can't pay Rashawn Evans. You can't pay Jayon Brown. You can't pay Adoree Jackson beyond his fifth-year option. You can't pay A.J. Brown. These are all cornerstone pieces that you want to make all these pieces fit, but at what cost do you pay others to jeopardize bringing those players back?
Six touchdowns in three seasons is the fifth overall pick. Right there, that's all I need. That's just not good enough. And I know some people might go, well, you know, it's not all about touchdowns. It's about receptions and yards. No, when you're the fifth overall pick, I expect you to get in the end zone. That's just, I'm sorry. That's just how I look at it. So that's another one. And you know, to your point and what we're talking about, I hope he has a good season because they're going to need him. They're going to need him to step up his game and be more productive than 601 yards that he was a year ago and two touchdowns. But at the end of the day, I just don't see him being here beyond next season. Adoree Jackson, I do. Mm-hmm. Adoree Jackson, I feel like there is a future for. You know, Christian Fulton just being brought into the fold, I think the future of the secondary when it comes to the cornerback position looks like Adoree Jackson and Christian Fulton. So that's how I see it. I don't see Corey Davis as a future member of this team, but hey, I've been wrong before, and in this case, I hope I am wrong. He proves me wrong.
Corey Davis' best game last year in a Titans uniform, 6 catches, 80 yards, and a touchdown. That was the Week 7 game against the Chargers. And after that, 2 catches, 4 catches, 2 catches, 1 catch, 2 catches, 3 catches, 3 catches, 4 catches. That was the rest of his season after that Chargers game. And, you know, he had 0 catches against the Patriots in round 1. He had 1 catch, which was the 3-yard touchdown off the trick play with Derrick Henry, the 3-yard touchdown from 22. And then he had 5 catches for 65 yards in the AFC title game against Kansas City. He's just okay. That's all he is. He's an average receiver that has a lot more talent than what the results show. And you can say that about a lot of receivers over the years in the NFL, and Corey Davis is just another one to come along the line. And it sucks that John Robinson spent a fifth overall pick on this guy because people will hold that against him, but you also could have gotten – there was a lot of talent in that first round. You know, Marshawn Lattimore, I know he plays the same position as Adoree Jackson. So maybe you don't get Adoree. Maybe you've gotten just Lattimore at 5 and then a different position at 18 with Adoree. But, you know, it's painful to look back at that draft. And the Bengals can say the same thing about John Ross, maybe the Chargers to a lesser extent with Mike Williams. But those three receivers were all those were the three top receivers out of that draft in terms of being drafted all early in the first round. And it's clear that those three were not worth where they were selected.
Yep. So we will see how that plays out. When we come back, Mike Tannenbaum of ESPN had some interesting comments about the Titans electing to keep both the quarterback and the running back. You'll hear that when we return. But do you own a small, do you own or manage a small business? Are you open and want to let people know about that? Then Free Business Friday on ESPN 102.5 The Game is for you. This Friday, we're offering free advertising to local businesses that are safely open and working. This is a no-cost, no-catch offer. Visit thegamenashville.com/FBF for more information. Free Business Friday is our way of supporting small businesses as we get through this together. From your friends at ESPN 102.5 The Game. We'll have more coming on The Rundown next. We're here to shock the system on The Rundown. Chase McCabe, Ryan Porth, Marquise Munson hanging out. Mike Tannenbaum, longtime general manager in the NFL, of course, with the Jets, later on with the Miami Dolphins, of course, has close ties to Ryan Tannehill from their days together in Miami, has some interesting comments discussing the Tennessee Titans electing to keep both Ryan Tannehill and Derrick Henry.
Oh, I think it was an absolute no-brainer. It's a great job by Tennessee. You look at the job that Ryan Tannehill did last year. When he came in, he led the NFL in yards per attempt. And we're seeing here his deep ball accuracy. When you can do that, Jay, you stretch the entire field. I thought it was really smart for them to franchise Derrick Henry because now they could pass the score and run to win. And when you look at Tennessee's young skilled players, besides Derrick Henry, you have a good, young, talented tight end in Jonnu Smith and an emerging receiver in A.J. Brown. They have a really good, young core nucleus of offensive skill players led by Tannehill. So, unquestionably, they should be the favorite. They got to the championship game, and that was not by accident.
There you go, Mike Tannenbaum saying that he believes it was the right move and that the Titans should be the favorite in the division. What do you think?
I think that's going to be the sentiment from a lot of ESPN or just national NFL experts going into the 2020 season. When you look at what the Titans did to make it to the AFC Championship game, the fact that they have a solid young nucleus surrounding a quarterback in Ryan Tannehill that showed last season that maybe the change of scenery from Miami to Tennessee is going to be more than just a short-term success for him. You have an up-and-coming head coach in Mike Vrabel. I think that's going to be a common theme heading into the 2020 season of people expecting this team to win the AFC South for the first time since the 2008 season. ESPN just came out with their ESPN.com just came out with their power rankings. The Titans are at 8, the Colts are at 13, and the Texans at 16. All the preview magazines that come out, all the preview podcasts and shows, everything, I think the Titans are going to be a common 2020 AFC South predicted winner.
Well, they should be. Even though right now I would say the roster is either on par with last year or maybe a little behind it, I still think that, you know, based upon what the rest of the division has done, they should be the favorite. Now, Indianapolis has gotten better. Indianapolis is going to have something to say about it, and I look forward to both of those matchups. But I believe when they kick off the season, whenever that may be, right now the NFL is saying they plan to kick off on time and they're even going to release their schedule this week, I believe that either the Colts and Titans will be neck and neck or the Titans will be a favorite over Indianapolis because John Robinson isn't done yet. And we know how he likes to do. He will tweak this roster until the very last day. There will be more signings that he'll bring in. Jadeveon Clowney continues to be out there as this being a potential landing spot for him. And we know throughout training camp he makes moves and will probably pick up a free agent that gets dropped from another team. He's very good at talent evaluation. So I have a lot of faith in him there. Adam Schefter did tweet that the NFL plans to release the preseason and regular season schedule later on this week. It's looking like they have contingency plans, but right now they're thinking everything is going to go on its schedule. But there are questions coming out of whether they will actually play London games this year. It's looking like they may not do that based on everything going with the pandemic. But so that'll be interesting to see if they cut that out completely just for a year.
Yeah, I would be surprised if any of the overseas travel for North American teams happens in the calendar year of 2020 or before there's a set vaccine. And I would hate it, but I think that could include the Preds Global Series against the Bruins in Czech Republic to open next season. I would be surprised if really any of that happens. Notre Dame Navy supposed to be in Ireland. I think a lot of that stuff is going to get pushed back.
My friends at Music City Bets on Twitter are telling me that the Titans are plus 200 to win the AFC South. The Colts are a slight favorite in Las Vegas to win the division as of right now. So those odds tend to change quite a bit. Go ahead.
I do think the national experts are going to underplay the Colts going into 2020. I think the national experts are just going to simply look at the playoff run that the Titans had and say, you know what, they should be the favorites. And this happens from time to time with unexpected playoff runs and people expecting the same to happen the next regular season. I can see the vast majority of people picking the Titans and then the Colts end up actually winning the division.
Yeah, and that would, in my opinion, be I don't know if it'd be a step back, but that, I guess it depends on what they do, you know, getting into the playoffs, but that's almost a lateral move because I think now everybody feels they need to go win the division. But
again, what if the Colts are 12-4 and you're 11-5?
Yeah, then I don't think you're going to get too many complaints. I mean, 11 wins is obviously a major improvement over, what is it, 4 straight years of 9-7 now? I mean,
right.
And that would be the 5th straight winning season for your franchise with 2 head coaches.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite an accomplishment. ESPN released their power rankings, and we did this last week with the NFL.com's power rankings, and as I looked at ESPN's, I feel like they're a little more on par with us with a few exceptions. They have the Titans 8th. They do have Green Bay at 6th. I don't agree with that. Tampa at 7th, so they have Tampa in the top 10, whereas NFL.com did not. So they go Kansas City, Baltimore, San Francisco, New Orleans, Seattle, your top 5, Green Bay, Tampa Bay, Tennessee, Minnesota, and the Dallas Cowboys rounding out the top 10, who signed Andy Dalton to be the backup quarterback this weekend. I like that move, but that's telling me something. It's telling me that Jerry is saying, you know what, Dak, you're not a priority right now. We got you on the franchise tag. We're going to just see how this plays out, and I got plan B if I need it. He's not willing to give in.
Well, so you think these two are connected?
I do.
That they signed Andy Dalton because of what is going on with Dak?
I do.
I don't know if I would go that far.
I think this is Jerry being Jerry playing a game.
Okay. Certainly possible. But who was their backup quarterback before Andy Dalton was
their backup quarterback? I can't remember.
Cooper Rush?
Sure. Yeah, that sounds right.
So, I mean, at the same time, we have to sit here and say, you know what? The Cowboys needed a backup quarterback. I'm more interested to know why Andy Dalton picked Dallas over other teams that probably would have had or had given him a better opportunity to start or at least play. If Dak Prescott's healthy for the entirety of the 2020 season, he's the starter.
Yeah, I think playing with Mike McCarthy probably. I mean, Mike McCarthy, say what you want, overrated at times, but he's been a pretty good coach and seems to work well developing quarterbacks. You can look at the relationship with Aaron Rodgers at the end and maybe have some questions, but I think a year with him probably isn't a bad thing for Andy Dalton, and he can take a step back.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of incentives with this contract. I think he could make up to $7 million on that deal. So I believe that there's a little bit of a tactic there with Jerry Jones. I could be wrong, but that's just my opinion. But I like it. I think Dallas has had a very good offseason, and adding him as the backup quarterback, that's an insurance policy that every team would love to have. I like it. So
I also think the fact that Jacksonville did not pick an offensive player in the first round with their 2 first-round picks, and the fact that they didn't end up with Andy Dalton tells me that the Jags are perfectly fine tanking for Trevor.
Yes, I think you could be right there. That is going to do it for this edition of The Rundown. We'll be back at it tomorrow at 9 for Ryan Porth and Marquise Munson. I am Chase McKay, but stick around. Darren Donovan Chase is next, ESPN 102.5 The Game.